You're listening to the Department of Energy Joint Genome Institute's Natural Prodcast, a podcast about natural products and the science and scientists of secondary metabolism. Hey everyone, welcome back to a new session of Natural Prodcast. I've got two things I wanted to tell you about in this introduction. First and foremost, our interview this week is with Professor Brian Bachman from Vanderbilt University's Chemistry Department, where he is the PI of the Laboratory for Biosynthetic Studies. Brian and I are old friends and colleagues, having both graduated with our PhDs from Craig Townsend's lab at Johns Hopkins. Brian went on to work at a groundbreaking company in the early 2000s called Ecopia, which was a very early genome mining company back when DNA sequencing of natural product pathways was hard and expensive to do. As I said, Brian is now at Vanderbilt, and he's doing some amazing research in and around drug discovery, which includes screening methods, genome mining in cave microbiomes, and using engineered biosynthetic pathways and enzyme systems to do synthetic analoging of some really complex bioactive natural product molecules. It's a wide-ranging conversation we had, and we could have gone on for a lot longer than we did, and I can say without reservation that Brian is one of the smartest people I've ever had the pleasure of getting to know. I hope you enjoy the conversation. If you do enjoy the interview, I'd encourage you to come check out the links to some cool papers in the show notes, which you can always find at naturalprodcast.com or through the JGI website at jgi.doe.gov. Second, I wanted to take a minute to introduce a new voice to the podcast. Please take a second to join me in mentally welcoming Natural Prodcast's new co-host, another old friend of mine, Professor Jacqueline Winter, or you'll pretty much always hear me call her Jackie, from Pharmacology and Toxicology at the University of Utah. Jackie was a grad student while I was a postdoc at Brad Moore's lab, went on to do some cool postdoctoral work, and now her research in Utah touches on all kinds of areas of natural product biosynthesis and drug discovery. There's a lot more to talk about there, and I'll be getting together a proper introductory episode with her in the near future when we can dive into that. And I'm also dying to talk in more detail about the JGI Secondary Metabolism Collaboratory, which is the big, huge, monster thing that's been keeping me busy for a long time now and almost ready for a real presentation to the world. But meanwhile, I've been sitting on all these great interviews recorded a few months ago at the SIMBY Natural Products meeting, and it's time to get this podcast rolling again. I've committed to the JGI comms team and therefore to you to put episodes out monthly, aiming for the first Thursday of the month moving forward. So that's the schedule. I'm committing to it, and you all can hold me accountable and yell at me if I slip again. My JGI coworkers are way too nice to yell at me, so that's going to be your job, audience. Send me those mean tweets or X's and emails. But anyway, today, please enjoy this great conversation with my good friend, Brian Bachman. Jackie, this is our first podcast together.
It is. Thank you for this opportunity.
I don't know if this is the first one we'll put out, but this is the first one that we're recording. So, yeah,
welcome. Sometimes the first podcasts don't come out.
That's very true.
Sometimes the first podcasts recorded don't come out.
This is true. Yeah. Brian was the very first recording I ever made practicing for the podcast, and I did not know what I was doing.
Yeah. That makes two of us.
So the audio quality was terrible. The hardware I was using was terrible. You know, now we got these fancy mics and everything.
All that talk about politics and religion too, it was not appropriate.
Yeah, no, that was not going to fly. So we're giving him a second chance now that I know what I'm doing.
Okay.
And we have today Brian Bachman from Vanderbilt.
Correct.
Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So Brian is a very old friend. We were graduate students together in Craig Townsend's lab way back in the day. And then you did a postdoc for a little bit there, and then went off to industry.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went to a SIM meeting and a Society for Industrial Microbiology meeting.
Which is where we are today, right, recording today.
Yeah, in the year 2000, and I was trying to figure out what to do with myself after graduate school. I'd graduated in August, and the SIM meeting was in August.
Right.
And started going to some talks, and you know, at the time it was really exciting when people would sequence a genome was, well, that hadn't really happened yet. It was, mm-hmm. it was unpublished at that point, but people would push out gene clusters maybe once a month at most, maybe twice a year, a full gene cluster would come out, and it was a very exciting event, and people in the research group would pore over it and argue about it and think about it and and debate it. But at this SIM meeting, you know, this guy was at a company called Ecopia was talking about, you know, a gene cluster a week, a completed gene cluster per week, and that really got me excited, and I stopped thinking about doing a postdoc and went to industry.
Right, right. Yeah.
To see what they had, what data they had.
And they had a lot of data for the time, right?
For the time. Well, nothing compared to now, but at the time there was, you know, maybe several thousand fully sequenced biosynthetic gene clusters from organisms that had not been, you know, previously evaluated. So that, you know, we started to see this potential of looking for compounds based on these gene clusters. And that was my job at the company. So I was the first chemist. So after having fun, you know, analyzing gene clusters for several months, they said, okay, now you have to go get the molecules. So I built a program there to do that.
I think we actually use some of your information from those days. As a grad student, I think I used one of your clusters to help close my cluster at the time.
Which one was that?
Nepridymycin.
Okay. Yeah. We worked on that one.
Yep.
Yeah. We also worked on the indianes. We worked on that. We had separate projects with John Thorson and Ben Shen.
Right.
And they were supposed to be orthogonal. And we, much to our chagrin, found that they had the same conserved polyketide synthase in them, which we still don't know why. 20 years later.
It's pretty amazing, though, how far we've come, though, too, when you start talking about going after single gene clusters.
That's right.
And it was a big deal. And you really had, I mean, the whole sequencing endeavor, how the cost, how much blood, sweat, and tears went into trying to identify that you had the right cluster before you sent it out for sequencing.
That's right. And, you know, in terms of just sequencing organisms by shotgun, which is what we did. We didn't even sequence the whole genome. We did a low-resolution shotgun pass where we sequenced 500 runs, and then we used those to find gene clusters in Cosmid libraries and sequenced those by shotgun. We had, you know, a dozen people doing that to get that one gene cluster a week. It was a huge endeavor at the time.
Yeah. Well, let's back up a little bit. So, Maybe if we back up a little bit and talk about your research at Vanderbilt and maybe how that industry experience shaped what it is that you do today.
So. Yeah, so I left a genome mining company doing natural product discovery and swore never to do it. Natural product discovery ever again. And I was really interested in synthetic biology, and I was really interested in and mechanistic enzymology and biosynthesis, you know, as the field was doing it. So I built a lab to do that. And then, so we had several targets and mechanistic enzymology targets and biosynthetic gene cluster targets that we did.
You were the first person I ever heard use the term retro biosynthesis.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I had this idea sitting in my bedroom in Montreal, where my industry job was, of evolving pathways one enzyme at a time from back to forward, and then using the terminal selection as a step. So it's bioretrosynthesis, and that's what I really wanted to do, and that's why I came back to academia, and I set that up, and we finally got that to work 10 years later. But in the meantime, we had people joining Vanderbilt who were doing drug discovery and neuroscience and other areas that were being very successful and taking preclinical candidates into the clinic, into INDs. And it seemed as though there had been a change from when I was in industry, because we were coming up with new chemical compounds as well, getting the phase one trials, phase two trials. And at the time, nobody was interested in licensing that technology or doing anything with it. So I was kind of discouraged. But then the Kahn and Lindsley group at Vanderbilt came, and they started to do these with preclinical candidates and get lots of interest. And I thought, well, I know that we can do this. So in 2006 is when I started our cave-based natural product discovery program at that point. Kept doing the other things as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cave-based. Yeah. So, down in caves. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so every natural product discovery campaign has to have a story, right? And it can be looking for drugs from marine organisms, in which case you get to go to exotic tropical locations and go snorkeling and scuba diving. And when my colleagues come back from these trips, they seem to be tanner and more rested looking than when they left. And the problem with caves, of course, is they're not quite as appealing as that. And we actually maybe come out maybe a little bit paler than we actually went in, and covered with bruises. So the story is let's look in the ecosystem that has never been exploited, because it's been shown over and over that when we move into new chemical ecologies, new ecosystems, we find new chemistry.
Right.
It worked in the marine ecosystems of marine actinomycetes and cyanobacteria. And we thought we could also, let's see what caves have to offer, because they're unique environments. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. These are structures that are millions of years old. This is a rooms that have existed for millions of years and relatively stable. No light, constant temperature, constant humidity, and they're actually good environments for bacteria to live in. So we thought, let's see. But they're also very, very low nutrients, so they're hypercompetitive. So our argument was that, this is the kind of place where we want to look for hypercompetitive organisms that need to defend each other or subdue one another with small molecules.
Antibiotics, to fight each other to over scarce resources, right? Yeah.
Or to communicate.
Or communicate.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I have a question. When you're sampling the caves, do you go after particular sources? Do you go after, like, sediment? Do you go after if there's any water? Or I guess when you're down there, is it something that strikes your fancy when you start collecting samples for later processing?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of different schools of thought with that. So some people are interested in cave microbial people are sort of interested in the more extreme portions of caves where you have to go, miles underneath the surface, where no human has ever tread, and that there's very, very, very low nutrients down there. And most of the energy is coming from chemoautotrophic and chemolithotrophic processes at that point. Those are very, very sparse. Those are deserts. They're very, very sparse areas. And we have certainly, when we first started caving, we sampled all through these areas, and you can do with a teaspoon of soil from outside, you maybe have to do a 10,000-fold dilution to plate that out. From the deeper you go in the cave, the less dilution. You can be down to 1 to 100, in a deep portion of a cave. So it really, really, really falls rapidly. But we eventually, after testing all these different zones, we eventually settled in on an intermediary zone where there was less nutrients but enough that you had a lot of biodiversity. So we choose environments that are close enough to energy inputs. So this is, for us, that's dripping water percolating through the soil, through leaf litter and humic acids and those kind of things. Close enough, and we spot them by, you can actually see consortia of microorganisms growing on the walls. They look like colonies.
Okay.
Different colors, all sorts of different colors. I mean, where else in nature, and they're not fungal.
Yeah.
Where else in nature can you go see colonies of bacteria just growing? They're not monocultures. They're,
sure,
they're definitely consortia. And there's layer upon layer upon layer upon layer of them. So we get them off of wet parts of caves, not dry, dusty, but wet. We like to get them where water's flowing and where formations are forming, so that we have things to point out and say, we swabbed this stalactite. We swab that gypsum flower, or that popcorn.
And when you bring back these samples to lab, because you're using culture-dependent method to look at that biodiversity, so how do you recapitulate, the media that you're trying to grow these organisms on?
That's an interesting question. We've used a lot of different approaches. Some of them have been, actinomycete-specific approaches, and you can enrich for rare actinomycetes by doing some tricks. Treating them with, boiling them in phenol, for instance, does a great job of getting rid of all the non-sporiformers. And streptomyces don't like that. So you can really, really enrich for non-streptomyces, actinomycetes by mistreating your samples in various ways. that a cave never experiences. But we've also done things where we've grown organisms in ultra minimal media. So you could take, you know, International Streptomyces Protocol media number 2, mm-hmm. ISP2, and dilute it by a factor of 100. And we have found organisms that will only grow on the minimal medium, which is probably more mirroring what happens in the cave environment.
Right.
You get more mm-hmm. unusual organisms that way too. But then they can subsequently be taught to grow on rich media mm-hmm. by culturing them.
Okay. What's the taxonomic distribution? Is it significantly different than what you might see in, say, soil or any other kind of environments?
No, I mean they're very rich environments, and they look a lot like most soil microbiome
okay.
systems. And it kind of makes sense because they are open and they're low, and things kind of flow, and water flows into them and floods them on a regular basis. So they are full of terrestrial microbes, but they're open ecosystems. They're not sealed off and closed.
Right.
But there's definitely types of organisms that are living there, mm-hmm. and we've moved recently from actinobacteria now, and we're focusing much of our efforts on myxobacteria.
Okay.
And they're also replete in caves, which makes sense because you have these biofilm walls.
Yeah.
And it makes sense that there are micropredators. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of, our orientation in the cave project is now switching from, you know, intermicrobial interactions, studying intermicrobial interactions by imaging interactions between predatory and non-predatory organisms.
Oh, okay.
From these environments.
What would you say is the ultimate goal of this research then? Is it to understand that ecology, or are you still doing drug discovery?
Yeah, so we're still doing drug discovery. So
right.
we have two separate projects. One is, you know, trying to understand the chemical ecology, the microbial chemical ecology, because we feel as though that stacks the deck for discovering of mm-hmm. molecules that do something. And that's a whole area of research, and it's more basic science, and it's less focused on translation. But we want to plug these organisms into a drug discovery platform.
Okay.
So to me, the elephant in the room with regard to genome mining-based approaches are that, other than resistance genes, you have no way of knowing whether or not a compound that you're isolating is going to be active. And even if you do have resistance genes, it may not be better than something that already exists. And
sure.
the hit rate on, if you have a target gene cluster and you have to find that compound, it's low. I mean, it's practically low.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get it if you really want to, you can do heterologous expression, you can do homologous expression techniques and stimulation techniques and that kind of thing, but it's a lot of work. So to us, about 6 years ago, we had thought the big gap in genome mining is not knowing if something is active before you isolate it, after isolating lots of things that were not active, new compounds
right.
that were not active. And
right.
So we built this assay platform that allows us, it's geared toward mammalian systems, but it allows us to assay on a single cell level against cell lines and against primary cells isolated from patients up to, you know, 12 markers at a time. And these are phenotypic markers. So they're things like, DNA damage.
Yeah.
There's a general marker for DNA damage, gamma H2AX. Or you could look at, you know, apoptosis markers like cleaved caspase. Or you could look at metabolism markers like phosphoprotein S6. So if there's a perturbogen present, a molecule that causes cells that are to be perturbed cells, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We'll find it. So it's a generic stress panel that we can now plug in, and it works on a metabolome.
Okay.
So we can look at it at the metabolome level. We fractionate metabolome into well plates, and we can use our fancy multiplexed activity metabolomics method to tell us what's active, which peak is active, before we even scale up.
Yeah.
So that's the reason that we did that, was to fit what we thought was a gap in the genome mining area, which is that potential wasted effort.
Wasted effort? Genome mining is wasted effort? Come on, man. Hey. You're killing me.
Well, it's not. I mean, it's not. I mean, I'm a big believer in and a big advocate of it, of the whole approach. But when you live it, and you're trying, you're at a company, and has it accelerated natural product discovery, microbial natural product discovery, compared to activity-based screening?
That's a good question. Has it? I think it must have.
I mean, if you were to take an organism of interest and grow it under 20 conditions and look for cytotoxicity, do you think it would be faster than that?
That's an excellent point. So
that's kind of a major focus of the group. Now, the cave organisms are there as a raw material. Very familiar with working actinomycetes. We can also genetic manipulate them. We can do strain improvements. We can do all sorts of things. So that's just where we like to work. Mm-hmm. Has the bonus of the chemical ecology projects on the side. But we are now doing genome mining projects where we're targeting what we think are privileged classes of molecular diversity, and then plugging that into these multiplexed activity assays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's great. I think, I mean, like you were saying, I think it's great to be able to prioritize what to focus on.
Yep.
Because there's so many gene clusters, but there's so many hours in the day, mm-hmm. and you really have to be educated with right. what you spend your time on.
Yeah, and I think anybody in natural product discovery in any field, and then even 30 years ago, would say it's the success in that is about choosing your battles.
That's right.
Yeah. Period. And anything you can do to stack the deck. And genome mining is one way you can stack the deck, but it's not sufficient on itself. You need more. You need other prioritization techniques.
No,
is it for resistance sure. genes or something?
Right, yeah. right. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. No, I think about this a lot in terms of what we're doing at the JGI with the Secondary Metabolites Collaboratory and trying to, you know, have a good catalog of what's out there so that we can do more comparative analysis and maybe sort of start to put some of these things into boxes more than they are right now. But yeah, at the end of the day, getting access to the chemistry and seeing what a molecule actually does is not something that you can do with bioinformatics. And I think, you know, I hope we don't ever lose track of that. Definitely in terms of me with what I'm doing in data wrangling, sometimes maybe I do.
No, but that stuff is, that's the raw material that you use to start to, you know, to do the discovery. And, you know, more and more people are coming up with techniques. And my colleague Allison Walker at Vanderbilt is mm-hmm. coming up with machine learning techniques just to look at clusters and start to predict what they do. And that's extremely exciting that, you know, and that's going to be sequence based. It's all about getting good sequence, good curation, you know, all that stuff. So, and I think that's kind of the way, other ways forward than I'm kind of going backward and looking at assays again, you know, mm-hmm. in some ways. And then maybe the forward way is these machine learning techniques and other things.
Yeah. So let's rewind a little bit more. What got you into natural product chemistry in the first place? What's your origin story? I usually start with that, but I didn't do that this time.
Okay. Well, I started off in organic synthesis. Mm-hmm. And I worked as an undergraduate for a pretty well-known guy, infamous person, actually. His name is Tomas Adlicki, and he, who recently passed away. Mm-hmm. It really got me interested in we were doing total synthesis, and I did that for several years, and it really got me interested in doing synthesis. But I couldn't stop thinking, well, these organisms are making these compounds. It looks a lot easier than what I'm doing. You know, they're breathing and pooping out molecules, and I'm using gallons of tetrahydrofuran and methylene chloride to make my milligrams in the end of compounds.
Yeah.
So, and his other thing was that he had the biotransformation that mm-hmm. was that he used in his work, and it was a chlorobenzene. Dioxygenase. So it took chlorobenzene and you bubbled it through a fermenter and it came out with a cyclohexadiene diol, an antimerically pure.
Yeah, I remember and this.
That's
yeah.
what really, really impressed me. I thought, wow, if we could just harness what microbes can do, and do synthesis? Can we do total synthesis in vivo? And most of my career could be described as trying to do that and failing for the last 20 plus years. And that's what led me to natural products. So after realizing that enzymes were specific for their substrates,
right?
That you couldn't buy, there wasn't an encyclopedia of enzymes at Aldrich that I could use to buy a Grignardase or a Vitigase or whatever I was looking for. Then I backtracked and I said, well, if it's possible to do this and life has figured out how to do this. So I started to look for people who were taking apart pathways to see how they worked. So if you want to build watches, you should probably spend some time taking them apart. So that's why I joined the Townsend Lab and moved away from synthesis and into biosynthesis and did that. And in the meantime, then while we were in graduate school, then Francis Arnold's papers came out on directed evolution and Pim Stemmer.
Right.
And at the time I thought that was problem solved. We have everything we need now to do this. And that's what really triggered me to come back to academia. But then I realized at that point, after doing directed evolution for a few years, that there was also caveats with that.
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
And we had to, you know, move. So synthetic biology now, and that would be the third research group area of my group now, has become, you know, so we call it, you know, fixing the unfixable projects, right? Where you take a natural product that is too complicated to make by chemical synthesis and make analogs using combination of mutagenesis and directed evolution.
Okay.
So that.
So it's medicinal chemistry, but with biological systems?
That's right. I mean, and it's actually not that that uncommon. So it could be called semi-synthesis. So you can knock out a glycosyl transferase and then use the free hydroxyl group and do some chemistry and get around pharmacological problems. But
yeah,
we wrote a review article that's actually called Fixing the Unfixable in Medicinal Chemistry, and it has example after example, either using synthetic biology or total synthesis or a combination of those, of overcoming pharmacological liabilities of natural products. So that's about a third of my group is working on, and they're working on a molecule called evrenanomycin, which is an octosaccharide and contains orthoester linkages and a couple aryl groups. And it's a complicated molecule, but we've been able to generate about 20 analogs at this point.
Okay.
And Casey Nicolau synthesized the evrenanomycin at Scripps, I guess. 22 years ago, and it's over 130 steps to make evrenanomycin. So
yeah,
it's not going to be analoging with that anytime soon.
Yeah.
I'm pretty proud of that. We've been able to generate so many analogs of something that wouldn't be doable using traditional chemical synthesis.
Right. Okay. And do they work? Do they
yes.
do new things, or it's the same things, or?
Yes. Yeah, so they, you know, we can make bioactive analogs that retain their activity and have different pharmacological properties.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So they're new compositions of matter. So one of the problems with the orthosomycins and these evrenanomycins is that the intellectual property is dead at this point.
Yeah.
You know, so you no company would ever be interested in developing them, doing the substantial amount of effort to develop them, because they're not protectable.
Right.
The intellectual property.
Right.
But if you can come up with new compositions of matter that are even marginally better, then that changes the game. And you can reopen the book and come up with antibiotics for multi-drug resistant infections and that kind of thing. So if you're still doing that thing that I started off doing as an undergraduate and not succeeding and still using all the tools that from, you know, mechanistic enzymology to natural product biosynthesis to genomics to directed evolution... but it's just the evolution. It really is a straight line going right back to my sophomore year of college.
So where do you see that in the future, in say 10 years from now? I guess what I'm thinking is, it feels like if you're, you know, working deeply in specifically in evrenanomycin, and analogs of that, you're really understanding one specific biosynthetic pathway.
Yep.
I guess how does this get bigger? Do you feel like you just have to know a pathway and really understand it in order to play the chemistry?
So it justifies mechanistic enzymology, it justifies taking apart pathways to understand how they work. Mm-hmm. You really do have to understand them.
Right.
And I would say that if you looked at the grant applications for the last 40 years for studying biosynthetic pathways, all of them said that a rationale for doing this is to make analogs, improved analogs.
Right.
But nobody does it.
Right.
Not nobody, but very, very few people are actively engaged in doing it.
Yeah.
And I think this is a huge potential for the field. There are, and you don't have to discover new molecules. You can make new molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And you could, you know, and you could study things that might be difficult to write a grant on right now, like another P450 or a glycosyl transferase. You probably would have a hard time justifying that basic science project. But if you convert that to a synthetic biology project, like Kiesling does, Taxol, or artemisinins, or morphine analogs, then it's a whole other area. So I hope that the field starts to merge with the synthetic biology community, with the metabolic engineering community, because mm-hmm. the skill sets are very complementary.
So you don't use a strictly synthetic biology approach to this, or you're just really like, molecular biology on plasmids and stuff to express things, or
what you need is what JGI is providing, which is a giant warehouse full of microbial sequences. So let's say you're interested in improving, a lead compound that you've discovered from microbes.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are, you could find a dozen other producers of that compound. And
it's getting there, yeah.
Right. Sure. And anybody who's ever done engineering work, you never want to stick with one organism. You want to have a mm-hmm. dozen organisms work. Sometimes something won't be soluble. Sometimes it won't be active in a heterologous host.
Mm-hmm.
So what you really need is a large toolkit of pieces in order to put them together to build pathways to make novel compounds or to find analogs,
Right.
And that was warp drives. One of warp drives' great ideas was to, to pick a lead and then use nature's SAR, right? By having large sequence.
Yeah. Yes.
Collections.
Warp Drive being the company that I used to work for, which is now Predict Ginkgo.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I think that was a great example, too, with having a large resource to compare these gene clusters to. If you find one of interest and there's multiple organisms, I think Ben Chen has a beautiful example of this, where, an organism, you can beat it to death by culturing it, you just never find the compound, and then you take another strain and it just produces it by, just looking at it.
Exactly.
And so it's nice to have alternatives to use and then figure out, regulation and why certain clusters are more amenable to work with, or even strains. And I think then it kind of lends more to microbiology, and the more we have, the more we can learn from those systems.
Exactly. And you can solve your problems by just finding a different producer. I mean, Bill Metcalf at UIUC used to go on about this, and they said they had a big genome mining program in phosphonates, and they could find an interesting new gene cluster, and then they would find it in seven other organisms, and one of those would just produce tons, right?
Right.
But I think it reaches into biocatalysis as well, and biotransformations just for industrial manufacturing, and getting away from petrochemical, petrochemistry, and going into green chemistry. So I think it's just a way for the field to really expand.
But isn't that really just genome mining?
Oh, yeah.
It starts with genome mining.
Everything starts with genome mining. And a great database.
All right. Awesome. So you have a poster here at the conference.
Yes.
tell us about that.
Okay. So the poster is on, something that's very new for us, which is a drug development project. It's one of these fixing the unfixable projects, where we have identified a lead using single-cell chemical biology that has a really interesting activity against leukemia cells.
Okay.
We got motivated enough in its remarkable activity and selectivity that we decided to identify the target of that organism. So we made chemical probes, and we did comparative proteomics, and then we did cryo-EM studies to find the binding site, and then we did CRISPR and directed evolution to evolve resistance in the active site. So we really, really understand there's a single target for this compound. It's single-digit nanomolar activity, and it's actually an enzyme called ATP synthase, so it's the last step in oxidative phosphorylation.
Yeah.
So now what we're trying to do is we're trying to improve the pharmacology of it. It has some issues. It has a short half-life in vivo, It has some, it's toxic, has some toxicity issues. So now we're trying to make analogs of that, and we're doing this fixing the unfixable stuff where we're able to take, do semi-synthesis with compounds that are the products of either, either the full biosynthetic gene cluster or gene knockout of the biosynthetic gene cluster to make a whole world of analogs, which we can then do classical pharmacological studies on, from microsomal stability studies to pharmacokinetics and PKPD studies and that kind of thing. So that's I'm trying. The whole poster goes from gene cluster down to an animal, a xenograft study. And that's kind of where I've been super excited about that work right now. I'm putting a lot of effort into that.
Unfixable in a sense.
Unfixable in the sense that if it's going to require 130 steps to make an analog, it's not fixable.
Right.
But if we can then co-opt life processes by making knockouts or knock-ins, doing some directed evolution, then it's fixable.
Got it. Yeah. Okay, great.
Tinkering.
Yep.
Brian, thanks so much. This is really great. Great conversation. So happy to see you, and looking forward to the next couple of days at the conference. I'm Dan Udwyer, and you've been listening to Natural Podcast, a podcast produced by the U.S. Department of Energy Joint Genome Institute, a DOE Office of Science user facility located at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab.
And I'm Jackie Winter from the University of Utah. You can find links to transcripts, more information on this episode, and our other episodes at naturalpodcast.com.
If you like what we're doing with Natural Podcast and you want to hear more science from JGI and its collaborators, check out JGI's other podcast, Genome Insider, with my colleague Menica Wilhelm. If you like what we're doing here, you'll probably enjoy Genome Insider too, so check it out. Our intro and outro music are by Jezzar.
Please help spread the word by leaving a review of Natural Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or wherever you downloaded it.
If you have a question or want to give us feedback, tweet us at JGI or to me at Dan Udwyer. That's DanUdwary. I'm also on Mastodon with that name at mstdn.science.
If you want to record and send us a question that we might play on air, please email us at jgi-comms. That's jgi-comms@lbl.gov.
And because JGI is a user facility, if you're interested in partnering with us, we want to hear from you. We have projects in genome sequencing, DNA synthesis, transcriptomics, metabolomics, and natural products in plants, fungi, and microorganisms. If you want to collaborate, let us know. Find out more at jgi.doe.gov/user-programs.
Thanks, and see you next time.